nutrition is not rocket science, really. People know that, you know, public health messaging has been effective enough that people generally know they need to eat vegetables. They should be eating fruit, whole grains, you know, not too much junk food. But it's actually doing that and putting that, you know, making those changes and being able to find the motivation or the reasons to do these kind of activities or make these changes and see the outcome as being worthwhile.
To reason with someone is to motivate them to do or accept topics, ideas, and issues through discussion and having conversations.
This podcast is about the relationship with ourself and the relationship with others, finding our stability and our self-worth, and how do we actually be in healthy relationships. We find this out through connection, compassion, and communication. Reach out, connect with me, like, subscribe, comment. I want to unpack whatever it is that we can to really get to the nitty and gritty of finding out how do we get better in ourselves and how do we get better in our relationships.
Welcome back to the podcast, Reason With Me. Hello, everybody. I'm just going to quickly ask, if you are listening to this, if you do like what you're listening to, please reach out. Please review on Google or Apple or Spotify. Please leave us 5 stars. This helps it reach other people and allow for more connection and more depth within our society and our world. Hope you enjoy this one. Grace Devine is an eating disorder and mental health dietitian based on Sydney's Northern Beaches. She specializes in helping people go from confused to enthused about their relationship with food, movement, and their bodies. With warmth, empathy, and skillful counseling, Grace guides her clients on a journey away from restriction towards balance and well-being. Grace is passionate about educating people on the intersect between food and mental health and is an advocate for holistic lifestyle medicine in treating mental illness. Grace is a mutual friend and now friend, and I really hope you enjoy the chat that we had, because I really did. Okay, welcome back to the podcast. I'm excited to do this one. Welcome to the podcast, Grace.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
Yeah, I think I grew up with your husband, I guess. and a lot of his friends, and it's cool. It's cool that we found ourselves here and now we can have a little chat. So I'm always very keen to figure out and learn more about what people do, and also like people that are like friends of friends. So that's always nice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Likewise. I'm so glad that I can be here with you.
Yeah. So let's jump straight into it. Who the hell are you and what do you do?
So my name is Grace. I am an accredited practicing dietitian. I am also a credentialed eating disorder clinician, which means I've done extra training in the treatment of eating disorders. And I've been a dietitian for 8 years now, which is pretty crazy to think about me. Working as a dietitian for 8 years, and yeah, I've worked in many different settings, from starting in a hospital to working in community health settings, but primarily a lot of the work and experience I've had has been working specifically in the mental health space. And that has been both in youth mental health. One of my first jobs was working at a Headspace centre, so working with young people 12 to 25 on, emerging mental health concerns, I should say, up into working in a mental health hospital, working in the subacute mental health rehab unit. So, yeah, mental health has definitely been a big theme in my work thus far.
That's amazing. There's a lot of dietitians out there, and I think a lot of people are seeking dietitians for reasons that I guess are like on the surface still. And then what I think, and I'm definitely biased, but such a huge part of it is your mental health, whether or not it's like your motivation
and control to be able to kind of stay on track with some eating, or, you know, being able to activate like a healthy lifestyle, or generally because you're stressed and overwhelmed and burnt out and anxious and depressed, and how that is going to impact diet. So it's really cool to see that there are people out there like yourself doing that, you know, I guess integration, because I think it all comes back to our mind at the end of the day and our body.
100%. And the connection between the physical body and mental health. And that is a, I guess, a body of research that has increased significantly in the last decade, particularly, you know, research done here in Australia. But I think in practice, generally, it's still, you know, I guess it depends on where you're working, but in some, you know, in many mental health, I guess, not facilities, but, you know, in the mental health space, a lot of the time it's still very much a medicalized approach in terms of managing, you know, mental illness. And we know that lifestyle intervention, whether that's nutrition, exercise, but also, you know, social interaction and all the other pieces of that puzzle, sleep, all of that has the power to drastically improve the symptoms of mental health conditions like depression. I feel like it's a slow trickle in from, you know, the translation of research into changing practice, with like nutritional psychiatry is a kind of emerging field that's super exciting, which is, you know, recognizing the power of nutrition in that space.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that. I didn't know there was a nutritional psychiatrist. I mean, that's amazing. But I think, I talk about this so much. I mean, the biggest factors of helping you manage your depression is your eating, your sleeping, your exercise, right? And self-care. We kind of can't do too much else that is generally what people want to talk about, which is, this is why, this is what's going on. I'm in this relationship, or, you know, I'm in a shitty job, or, you know, I've got some older trauma that's sort of holding me back. It's like, we can move through some of that, but you're gonna do it at such a pace that's so one step forward, two steps back, because you're eating shit, you're sleeping terribly, and you're not moving your body at all. So the more and more we do it and research and get really real, I think people maybe are starting to shift into that mind body sort of connection of it all. And something you said off recording is, people know how to do it. Well, a lot of people have heard enough to potentially be able to do it, well, at least the basics. And
it's not, like, nutrition is not rocket science, really. People know that, you know, public health messaging has been effective enough that people generally know they need to eat vegetables. They should be eating fruit, whole grains, you know, not too much junk food. But it's actually doing that and putting that, you know, making those changes and being able to find the motivation or the reasons to do these kind of activities or make these changes and see the outcome as being worthwhile. And that can be really hard for people when they've got so much other stuff going on, or maybe there's barriers to doing those things, whether that's, you know, homelessness, for example. Obviously, it's hard to cook a healthy meal if you haven't got, you know, somewhere to prepare that food.
True.
True. I think what you said before about, you know, that's those basic things of eating well, exercise, sleep. I often, you know, talk about that stuff in practice too, when people are really, I guess, worried about what's going on, or, you know, if we just focus on like the weight piece, for example, because, you know, a lot of people do, you know, seek a dietitian for weight loss, but in actuality, we actually have very little control over our weight or our number on the scale, because there's so many factors that influence it, like genetics and environment and stress. But the things that people actually have control over is eating and exercise. You know, what you do and what you eat is the factor you can actually change. You can't change necessarily your environment. You can't change your genetics, but focusing on the behaviors and letting the behavior change be the outcome itself rather than changing your weight be a goal. I feel like people find a lot better, I guess, sense of, you know, self-efficacy, sense of success when they can, you know, achieve those goals that are actually, you know, achievable. And working with a, you know, behavior change therapist or, you know, someone who's trained in motivational interviewing, those kind of things can help them get there.
So I love the way you that you put that. I guess the common theme, because you've worked with people that are in quite dire straits and quite complex and acute, but I imagine you've also worked with the complete other side of the spectrum, which is, you know, your everyday people that I guess are functioning, living ordinary lives and doing what they're needing to do. What do you think the common theme is? Because no matter the extremes or the polar opposites, we still struggle with not having that chocolate or, you know, wanting to have the, you know, takeout every couple of weeks or whatever, or every day or whatever, whatever the people's sort of spectrum is. But what do you think the common theme is to why that's so difficult to change that behavior?
Two things come to mind. I think the first, and this I find applicable to almost all the clients that I work with now in my private practice, whether they have an eating disorder, whether they, you know, just want to improve their general health, whether they've got ADHD and they're struggling to eat regularly, or any other many presentations. The common factor I find that people are experiencing is a sense of confusion or a sense of just second guessing what they should be doing or feeling like, you know, something's missing or they can't figure out, I guess, a problem that they feel that they have. And I see my role in that is helping people tune into what is their own intuitive knowledge about their own body. I think part of that is in this diet culture driven world that we live in, we are, you know, told that we need to follow all of these diets in order to lose weight, that we need to be a certain way in order to be healthy. Also just in general with nutrition, there's so much information and misinformation out there about the best way to eat and endless new fad diets. Every month there's a new diet trend. So just all of that noise, people come to me and they feel so confused and just like,
what the fuck do I do?
Not getting it. And, you know, a lot of what I do is just bringing people back to basics. And they realize, oh, no, I actually do know. I do know what I need to do. And then, helping them, putting that in place is the next part. But,
Okay.
That's definitely a big one.
So you're helping them get more clear and sort of untangling which bloody thing am I meant to follow and how am I meant to do all this. And you said something about understanding and knowing what your body needs. Can you tell me more about what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I guess leaning on, I guess, more of an intuitive eating, you know, intuitive approach to eating and intuitive approach to having their relationship with food. And intuitive eating is all about, I guess, tuning into what does my body need? What do I actually feel like right now? You know, what are the foods that are going to make me feel good? And that can be, you know, in reflection of past experiences, knowing that, you know, when I do eat more nutritious food, my mood is actually better. But it's also about stripping away the external labels of good and bad that society and diet culture has given us. So a really big piece of intuitive eating is completely removing those labels from food and just seeing all food as neutral. You know, there's no angel wings on a bunch of kale, and there's no devil horns on a Big Mac. Like, there's no good and bad, because when you have those labels of good and bad, people internalize, and especially if they've been, using those words from a young age, from whether parents or teachers or friends or whoever, so typically I have clients who come in and say, oh, I was so bad on the weekend. I had a pizza. I went out. I had, too many drinks. It was just really, really bad. The problem with that is then if you're eating these bad foods and then you internalize that you are now bad, it's just like double dipping on this bad mood of feeling like crap because you've done this bad thing. And so it's taking all of that away and removing all of that that moral-based language when it comes to food, and just seeing food for what it is, which is, nutrition, fuel, but also enjoyment and, tuning into whatever it is for that individual that they need at that point. Hopefully that makes sense.
It makes too much sense, because now there's so many angles and avenues I want to go down. Yeah. And I don't know. Well, maybe we're going to get lost, but we're going to try. I am going to start with, and this might throw you, I'm going to make you work today, Grace. Okay. How do I intuitively eat if my guts are so fucked? Why would I trust this thing that I'm meant to sort of feel in my gut when my gut is literally just doing somersaults all the time, and I have, this problem no matter what I kind of put into it or whatever? It's like, I'm not sure. So I don't know how to be intuitive with myself. And I imagine that's just the same for a lot of people. And there's lots of factors into why that can be hard, even just tuning into the body. But for me, and I know for a lot of my clients and a lot of other people, is how do I trust my gut when my gut is just literally full of shit?
When your gut can't be trusted. Yeah. And yeah, it is full of shit. Haha, I get it. That took me a second. That is a really excellent question, and one that does come up a lot with clients. And yeah, I guess I should preface the conversation around intuitive eating is that at times, for many different reasons, it's not appropriate for everyone immediately. For example, sure. people with, whether they have, certain gut issues like IBS, which the coincidence of IBS with mood disorders and anxiety is extremely high. And they both, influence each other. And that's the brain-gut connection. We could talk all about that as well, and the microbiome.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that later, perhaps. We'll be here for hours.
No, I am keen to talk about that.
Yeah.
This might go down to we just talk about our digestion for a while. But
yeah, we could. I mean, I literally talk about poo all day with my clients.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I guess in those cases, sometimes it's and another example I should add where intuitive eating is really challenging is for athletes, where their nutrition needs are elevated. They need a lot more energy and a lot more protein than what they would if they weren't doing the activities that they're doing. But because of the frequency of their exercise and the impact on during exercise, your appetite is suppressed, and being able to eat enough, is actually really hard. And if you were eating intuitively and only eating when you're hungry, you wouldn't get nearly enough of what you actually need. So I guess in certain cases like that, and with gut gut issues, I do sort of, I guess it's maybe a modified approach of intuitive eating called reflective intuitive eating, which is where, you know, tuning in could just be as simple as like keeping, you know, monitoring what's actually going on, noticing and observing, you know, I'm eating these foods and then these are my symptoms associated with these foods, and, you know, keeping a food log or a food diary for a period of time. And just being really curious and noticing and observing what's going on. And I guess making changes and seeing all nutritional changes as experiments and noticing, okay, if I have this day where I eat this much of these foods, it creates this effect. The following day, I'm going to play with it and tweak it and see what the effect of that is. And so it's still intuitive in that it's tuning in to what's going on.
Yeah, but,
and, gotcha. And drawing those conclusions and, you know, drawing lines between things and, you know, like appreciating the impact of those things, whether or not that is, you know, intuitive eating in its purest form as per, you know, the way it's been defined. But it's intuitive in that it's personal and it's authentic to you as an individual.
Ooh, yeah. Love that word, authentic. That's a good kicker into it. It's being able to reflect. I like it being reflective as well. Oh God, there's so many ways I want to talk about this, but I guess just not as deep.
Yeah.
This morning, I mean, you mentioned this off recording as well, and you said that people with ADHD sometimes forget to eat. And what did I do this morning? Is rushed out the door and forgot to eat. So it was funny when you said that. I was like, oh, crap, go and eat. But the thing that I kind of been, I guess, you know, again, intuitively being very reflective, I'm very, very conscious around a lot of things at the moment, my eating, my sleeping, my exercise. Not at the moment, I always am, but really geeking out and nerding out about it at the moment, really, you know, I love it. So I guess just on a surface sort of level question, if I don't feel like breakfast, but I've been told to always have breakfast, most important meal of the day, what do I do, Grace? Do I just not eat?
It's a good question. I will say the blanket rule of breakfast being the most important room meal of the day is a myth.
We've been lied to.
Not everyone has to eat breakfast. But, I mean, and that's breakfast as you know it, you know, eating first thing, but waking up, eating first thing in the morning. For many people, they just don't feel like it and it upsets their stomach and they're not hungry, and forcing something down at that time is not necessarily. But if you are someone who is underweight or someone, you know, who is, you know, struggling with an eating disorder, someone who is, you know, exercising a lot and, you know, your nutrition requirements are elevated, missing breakfast puts pressure on other meals in the day to get enough in at that time.
Yeah.
You know, it's looking at your own context and figuring out what is going to work best for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be the same thing every day by any means. Often sometimes I find as another example, I have, you know, a lot of clients who not hungry in the morning, skip breakfast, just maybe have some random snack that they find on the go for lunch, like a, you know, a croissant or a toasty or something that's not necessarily super nutritious, and then come the end of the day they are absolutely ravenous, they eat everything that comes into sight, they have a huge meal, and they really struggle to regulate how much they eat at night because, you know, their appetite's really caught up. And because they eat so much at night, they're not hungry in the morning because, that you know, their stomach is still, you know, quite full from the night before. So then that cycle repeats and you know, they're like continuing that sort of bottom loading effect. Whereas trying to eat more regularly, you know, trying to just start with a small breakfast, you know, eating smaller, more frequent meals throughout the day, they might find that their appetite is actually a lot easier to regulate.
Yep.
And, you know, with that comes more stable energy levels, more stable mood, and less of that afternoon, like, got to eat everything in the kitchen sink effect, which happens a lot.
For sure. So it's all about structure and routine, right? I guess creating predictability and consistency.
Absolutely.
I guess that touches everyone in all facets, no matter what you're kind of facing, is building structure and routine around it and getting reflective, intuitive around how you want to build that based on your context.
Yeah. Context. Yeah. And that's the key word. At the moment in, I also work in a mental health hospital at the moment alongside my private practice. And in that I do group education, and there's always questions that come up that, like, what's the best food we should eat? Or what's the number one thing we should never do? Or, you know, there's always these big, all-encompassing, big sweeping questions.
These are my next two questions. Don't ask Grace those.
Oh, you can ask.
Just kidding.
But the answer is context. It depends.
Yeah.
There's no one size fits all with nutrition, and there's no magic bullet for anything. It's all you know, about your own requirements, your own personal preferences, your own culture when it comes to food, and all of the different factors that make up that puzzle, and, you know, make up your own personal relationship with food. And honoring that is important too.
So that brings me on to my next much deeper question. I guess we can try and put it into a little bit of a bubble, but I guess maybe it is a bit more specific. But essentially, gut issues, right? If that's the broad term, IBS, leaky gut, you know, bloating, all these sort of things that obviously disrupt the gut that creates problems, whether it be constipation, diarrhea, consistently going to the bathroom, discomfort, all those things. Hopefully that builds enough of a in that bubble, right? The bubble is shit. So my journey was it's ongoing. It's never ending, actually. But the one of the doctors that I went and saw, a specialist in, you probably say this better than me,
gastroenterology.
That's the one. So, you know, I've seen a couple of specialists in that space. Mm-hmm. And one of them said something pretty profound. I'd love to get your thought on it, that science has not caught up to where it needs to in terms of understanding the brain and understanding the gut or gut brain, to be able to distinguish more and understand more around irritable bowel syndrome and all those issues that I sort of pointed out, which for me was like, so I've got to wait until science says something different. And until then, I sit on the spectrum of a gut issue that doesn't have much more to it. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think the gut, and I mean the brain gut connection, but the gut in general has been a real hot topic of research for the last decade. I think I can't remember what the stat was, but like the proportion of studies, you know, of human body studies, the proportion of studies specifically related to the gut far outweighed any other system in a particular couple of years ago. And so it's a really hot topic, but the trouble is, I think the more we know, the more we realize we don't know in terms of the complexity of the gut and how much of an impact it has on the rest of the body. But so far, the evidence points to say that the impact is really, really big of, mm-hmm. you know, of the health of the gut and the impact of that on all parts of the body, really in particular the brain, but also the heart, immune health, for lots of different reasons. And if we talk about, you know, talking about the microbiome, we mentioned that before, the microbiome referring to all of the trillions of bacteria that live inside of our digestive system, but in particular the large intestine. And we know now that the health of the microbiome is very much influential on the health of a lot of the rest of our physical body. And, yeah. you know, from conditions from diabetes to, you know, general obesity, as well as, and I, you know, hate that word, but, you know, the metabolic conditions like, you know, heart disease, well as mental illness. And we know that the diversity of the microbiome is positively related to better outcomes. So the more diverse the microbiome, the more different types of bacteria all living inside us, the better our health outcomes are. But the trouble is we've now got people coming through with selling microbiome testing kits and, you know, kits that you can get sent to your home and test your microbiome, which is all well and good, but we don't have the data set to compare your results to a, you know, population-based, you know, set of data to say what's, you know, what's the perfect microbiome. And in fact, we know, like, each person's individual microbiome makeup is as unique as their fingerprint. You know, it's such a personal thing. And two people with the exact same microbiomes, not that that would exist, but two people would have totally different, I guess, outcomes, because each bacteria has their own genes, and the gene expression of those bacteria influences our own human gene expression. So it's such a complex organism, and it's a bit of a head fuck when you go into it. Really, it's like, wow, this thing is crazy.
Totally.
But to go back to your question about how do you, as a you know, a client or patient of someone who says, yeah, we just don't know, that's really hard to cop, because you're like, well, I'm dealing with this stuff every day. But I think in that situation, again, like I said before, a lot of it is experimentation, figuring out what works, trying different things, and also recognizing that it's not just food. Food is a piece of the puzzle, whether, you know, and that is very real for many people. If they do have IBS, or they have, you know, IBD, or if they have lactose intolerance, or they have other, you know, diagnosable intolerances or allergies, yes, food has a big part to play in mitigating those symptoms. But also the impact of stress on the gut and anxiety and you know, other mental health issues. It's a bi-directional relationship between gut symptoms and mental health symptoms. They both increase each other. So people find that managing their stress is actually as effective as modifying their diet and reducing the symptoms of IBS, which is, you know, in this whole new emerging sort of therapy of gut hypnotherapy. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So they've done studies on that, and it's like actually working on calming the nervous system helps to release that misfiring that's going on in the gut of, you know, that connection between the brain and the gut. Calming that down means that the gut relaxes, and then the incidence of those symptoms like bloating and diarrhea calms right down as well. So it's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, and that's such an interesting, I'm just really glad that you have that perspective as well, because I mean, you said they're almost on par. I would say stress is, you know, way more important than what we're putting in, because of what it can do. It doesn't matter what we put in. It's like stress will just form it into something nasty. And then create lots of problems, inflammation and stuff like that. So obviously you're working with
the underlying cause as well. Like changing your diet isn't necessarily addressing that.
Yeah. So I guess that's my, you know, curiosity around, you know, a dietitian's role when it comes to that. And what, you know, if stress is such, and you're working with some complex disorders, I mean, eating disorder is a very, very complex, I think, very under-researched and under-understood, is that a word, eating disorder, the way that we see it in terms of mental health, because it's, you know, can just wreak so much havoc. And I think it's very shame-based and addiction and trauma-related for pretty much all cases, big or small. So that to me means, you know, them, people that sort of living with that sort of thing versus, you know, people in mental health realms, I imagine talking about stress and it is going to be a big part of a dietitian's role. So, I mean, not a lot of dietitians, I imagine, are maybe doing that as much as someone who's specializing in mental health as well. But yeah, how does that come through with the people that you're kind of working with when you are kind of talking about anxiety and stress and nutrition?
Yeah. It's definitely an area of my practice that is perhaps slightly beyond the scope of, you know, definitely beyond the scope of a new grad dietitian. And it's something that I've, you know, my skills in counseling that has developed over time and through doing extra training and also, you know, clinical supervision, which is, you know, really, really important for all clinicians. But yeah, being able to learn to manage that, I guess, not in treating it in a therapeutic sense necessarily, but just having an understanding of stress and, I guess, in working with someone, helping them recognize that the stress they're experiencing is related to the eating issues they're experiencing and helping them draw that line and then perhaps where appropriate, encouraging them to seek psychological support in managing that as well as, you know, dietetic support. And particularly in the case of eating disorders, you know, the, I guess, best scenario is someone who's got a GP to manage their medical, you know, medical monitoring, a psychologist to help them manage the, you know, the psychological aspects, the trauma, and then a dietitian to help them understand the, I guess, the obviously their nutritional requirements for the impact of that on the eating disorder, and, you know, working together within that multidisciplinary team. Evidence-based, what the best evidence has, let me rephrase, the evidence we have shows that having all three is, you know, leads to the best outcomes in terms of recovery. But, you know, and just mentioning that as well, I guess, you know, eating disorders are very, very diverse. Not all eating disorders are the same. And I guess often for most people, the typical image that comes to mind when you think of someone with eating disorder is typically an adolescent girl with anorexia. Yeah. But in reality, anorexia only makes up less than 5% of all of the people in Australia with an eating disorder. And the most common eating disorder by far, above more than 40%, is actually binge eating disorder, which is often a more silent and perhaps less acknowledged eating disorder because it's easier to hide, easier to mask. It's not immediately obvious looking at someone in the way that perhaps it is with people with severe anorexia, that they may be suffering with a problem, and, you know, perhaps they present to their GP for that problem and they get told to lose weight because you know, they have a high BMI. which very much contributes to the long-lasting nature of binge eating disorder. And a huge part of that is the shame, which you mentioned, but also stress. And in many cases, like eating to the point of, you know, where it becomes a binge, for many people with binge eating disorder is their self-soothing and is their way of managing distressing emotions and has kept them safe, whether they've, you know, been in a stressful home environment or they, you know, are suffering with, you know, other sort of, just distressing life experiences, numbing themselves through food, you know, is their way of escape.
Totally.
So acknowledging that is huge.
Yeah, I mean, hence its addictive nature, right? Because it's doing something that not a lot of other things do.
Absolutely.
In a powerful way. So how would you describe binge eating or what categorizes it?
I guess the diagnostic statistic manual, the DSM, defines it as actually I can't remember exactly off the top of my head the frequency.
Fair enough.
But like in terms of on it, and like obviously there's limitations of the DSM, but binging is defined as eating more than what a typical person would eat in one sitting, and for that binge eating to come with significant psychological distress. So, you know, we probably, you know, all of us probably binge eat now and then, particularly, you know, Christmas Day is a typical example. And binge eating now and then isn't necessarily problematic, but it's when it's happening frequently and it's coming with distress that it becomes a disorder. Is at least disordered eating. You know, many people probably also meet the threshold for, you know, subclinical binge eating disorder, where perhaps the frequency isn't, you know, every day, but if it's happening often enough, and whether or not it also comes with purging behaviors like vomiting or using laxatives, which are also common in that group. I guess that's what it looks like. Comes with a lot of shame is definitely a common factor.
Yeah. I mean, it's like anything, right? It's sort of what, you know, people can go out and have a drink, but if they're doing it in a way that has, you know, significant negative consequences and it's having those big impacts on their life and others around them, then, we start to look at it as more problematic. So what would be the significant distress? Like when you say while they're doing it or the lead up or... I mean, obviously, shame is attached to before, during, and after generally.
I think it's different for different people. But if I think about some of the clients I'm working with at the moment, you know, I've got one client at the moment who's in her 60s and has been binging since she was 11 years old. And for her, it's almost like an out-of-body experience when it's happening. She'll just kind of go to the kitchen and then, you know, half an hour later she's realized that she's eaten, you know, an entire loaf of bread and butter without necessarily being conscious in the moment. Or for other people it's, you know, they've had a really shit day, so they'll drive to the supermarket and they'll go and get lots of chocolate and they'll eat it in the car, and that is part of the, I guess, the very secretive nature of binge eating disorder as well. It's definitely, and I mean many eating disorders, all I think, yeah, majority of them, I mean, again, very different presentations person to person, but yeah, that sort of secretive wanting to hide away nature of them is also part of what helps maintain them. Because it's easy to, you know, it's easy to hide.
Yeah. So the big kicker for me around this whole conversation, I guess, is the underlying, sometimes overt, but generally, you know, covert, is the shame attached to it. So even at the start, we're talking about shame attached to, like, I did such a bad thing on the weekend, which I would say quite a lot of our society has attachments to that sort of notion. So if we start shame from that level, higher level, where it's still about how I see me and how I feel about myself because of this thing that I've done. So there isn't necessarily guilt, which I did a bad thing, is that the more I am a bad person, or I, this is associated with me being bad as a whole. And then obviously the other end of the spectrum, where we're looking at punishment, and, you know, restriction and self-soothing and, you know, survival-based coping mechanisms in order of using food or not using food, and how that's also attached to, you know, I'm not good enough, or I don't deserve, or I'm not worthy, or I'm insignificant, and, or, you know, this is how I'm going to hate myself today by doing this. Is that shame is such a spectrum, but it obviously touches quite a lot of the spectrum in a lot of people. So that's, I guess, like, again, you know, you might be working with people that are probably in need of more than, you know, like that, they need that multidisciplinary team. But I guess what's your role when it comes to that shame part of it? How does that come about, and where do you kind of go with it, normalizing and neutralizing food, I think you said at the start. But yeah, how does that play a part in the whole realm of dietitians and nutritionists?
It's definitely a tricky one, and not something that you can just unpick or undo in one session. And definitely takes work on the client's behalf as well. But I guess, you know, part of a lot of what I do, particularly in working with young people with restrictive eating disorders, is psychoeducation around, you know, the importance of nutrition and all the things that food does for us, and, you know, different, whether it's talking about the different macronutrients and how they impact different parts of our body, and just helping them believe and helping them understand that they deserve to eat. They don't need to go to the gym in order to eat. They don't need to, you know, only they're not only entitled to this certain restrictive amount of food, which the eating disorder would have them believe. They deserve to eat, and they were given that right to eat the day that they were born. And just, you know, that's a big sort of theme that comes up, particularly for, you know, thinking of another client who, for them, restricting their eating is almost a form of self-harm, because they feel like they don't deserve it. And so helping them reframe that, and whether that's doing reframes, where, you know, asking the client to picture a child in their life, whether it's their niece or nephew, or perhaps if they're an older client, picturing themselves as a child, and, you know, thinking of what they would say to that young person if they were expressing that they didn't deserve to eat. And of course they're going to say, of course you deserve to eat, you need to eat, you need to eat so you can, you know, so you can run around, so you'll grow, you know, nice and tall, so that your hair will be healthy and your skin will be healthy, and all of these things that we know and we can easily apply to other people. But helping them reframe that to themselves.
Great. That's very powerful. And I think, you know, and it really crosses over to, again, a lot of things that people can see what they're doing to themselves and how much it's lacking compassion And that, you know, we've just found these different ways to make us escape or, you know, help us cope that, yeah, our backwards and the beliefs are all distorted. So,
yeah.
No, that's really cool. I really like that. Just really thinking about how you would treat someone else or what would you say or do to a younger version of you, really that.
Yeah.
You know, child work as well.
Can I just add as well, just thinking about that, yeah, disordered nature of that belief of, like, have to, you know, earn your food. That's such a, you know, common notion, particularly in, you know, in going to gyms. And I remember just last year I went to a gym class. It was just a bit of a random one. And it was, you know, 6 a.m. and the trainer's up there saying, yeah, let's go. Let's earn our breakfast. And I could have slapped her because I'm like, I don't need to earn my breakfast. Actually, I earned my breakfast by waking up. That's all I had to do. And like just that kind of attitude towards food, which is so pervasive in modern society. And there's times where, you know, in particularly in those environments where I almost feel like the whole world has an eating disorder. Or is disordered
in their
relationship to food because of diet culture. It's disordered. Yeah.
We have distortions in our mind based on our experiences, which if we're all living in this society, a lot of us are going to get.
100%.
And we don't have to ask for it. It's just going to be right there.
Yeah.
You know, just as a side note, I'm so off track, I'm going to say anyway, but the ads that I'm watching on TV at the moment are like, you know, buy you foods, you know, get these pre-planned meals or whatever, and they're targeting people. You're too busy. Your life's very stressful. The only way that you're going to be able to do this is blah, blah, blah. And it's like, nah, that's a future me problem. And then future me arrives and they're like, no, we're stressed out. This is why you need to build and find the finance to be able to just have meals in the freezer ready to go. Now, I'm not sure about whether or not those meals are good. Less the point, more of like, we're actually feeding into you're busy. Let's not change that. Let's just adjust to the shit lifestyle that you obviously are feeling very pressured by and at least make sure you're eating. You know, it's like, that's not the standard that I want
to. Let's not worry about prioritizing what's important. Let's just, you know, fit it into this other convenient model that, you know, de-skills you in, you know, being able to cook a healthy meal. But I think that's really interesting. And that is also reflective of the way that diet culture is evolving. And I feel like it's realized that now generally we know that fat shaming is not cool. And there's less of that in the mainstream, but it's kind of morphed into this thing of, you know, optimizing and, you know, doing it to feel good. You know, eat this. I saw one the other day that was a meal replacement shake, which is, you know, a weight loss tool. And it's this very slim girl who's having it because it's so convenient. It's nutritionally balanced. I'm like, that's not a meal. That's not food. It's a weight loss shake and it's being targeted to help her feel good. And it's got prebiotics for gut health because that just makes it better. And it's just like the way that this kind of messaging is evolving in different forms and like diets have evolved and just because it's a money-making machine and people will watch that and people will buy that. And then they will be disappointed because they don't look like that girl. And it's a very, oh God, I could talk about this for hours.
I know, well. I've opened the can of worms again right at the end. I tend to do
that. Worms
but I really resonate with you and I think I share your concern for the world. And hopefully, you know, people do kind of get this message today. And I guess, you know, and I like how you brought it back to like, it's actually all of us. You know, we don't have to wait until this gets so complex in a disordered eating that all of a sudden we fit the criteria for some eating disorder and then we're blah, 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 blah. You know, we're all on a spectrum of whether we are well or unwell and how unwell we can get. I think it's good to be able to reflect on that as, you know, oh, well, I'm not anorexic, or I'm not binging every day. It's like, well, yeah, but your relationship with food and relationship with your own self is negative or toxic, or
you're still thinking about food every day. You're second guessing everything you're eating, and you're entering it all into this app, and you're letting that dictate what you're allowed to eat later in the day. That is a problem.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's control, which, as you would know, you know, massive part of eating disorders is control, and that's safe. I think we're doing that in lots of different ways. And look, it's a very powerful coping mechanism, but also very devastating across the board of what control can do. Right. So so many more things I want to talk to you about, but I guess to round off, I guess, what is something, I know you've given us lots of tools and tips and things to reflect on, and I'm very grateful for that, but what's, I guess, something that, you know, if we're keeping it in that foundational way that you offer to your clients or I don't know, your audience, that just brings it back down to trying to simplify a little bit.
Again, it's going to be very different depending on the client. But I might reference one of my amazing dietitian colleagues, Shane Jeffries, who is an eating disorder and sports dietitian. Up in Queensland, and he sort of created this model that's now used widely in practice called the RAVES model, and it's, I guess, a bit of a model of nutritional rehabilitation, that, you know, it's like getting back to basics of the things that are important and what to prioritize as people move from disordered to maybe a healthier relationship with food. And it's almost in sort of three phases. So, and it's an acronym. So R in RAVE stands for regularity. The first thing we do, you know, just to get back to some sort of semblance of, yeah, making it things a bit more structured, is regular meals. Doesn't matter what the meals are, just eating regularly is the first priority. And that's breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks in between. The A is adequacy. So that plays more into the nutritional quality and the diet quality of those meals, thinking about the macronutrients, getting enough protein, you know, getting enough vitamins and minerals. And those sort of two things, regularity and adequacy, are your foundational priority of nutrition. Mm-hmm. Once you've kind of got those in place, you move on to phase two. So the V is variety. And we know variety is beneficial for lots of different reasons, but particularly if people have quite a rigid approach to food, or maybe they're eating enough, but they're only eating a very short set list of safe foods. It's about incorporating more new foods that maybe feel scary, but are an important part of that, having a healthy relationship with food. The E is eating socially. So for many people, you know, eating in front of other people is really stressful or scary, because they feel people are judging them. They feel like other people are going to judge how much they eat or what they eat. And getting back to eating socially is a really important, you know, part of our social life. We're social beings, and sharing meals is such a big part of our culture. So getting back into eating socially sort of comes next. And then the last one of S is spontaneity. So being able to, you know, on a whim, get invited to go out for dinner with friends, go out, have a good time, eat, drink, be merry, and then have that not derail your life for the next 3 days of guilt and shame. Mm-hmm. You know, that's down the list. But again, a really, you know, when people are able to do that, that's a really good sign that their relationship with food is healthy and balanced. And then they're the two phases. Then the third phase is intuitive eating, which is sort of almost like the far off goal. And that's why I said at the start, intuitive eating is not necessarily appropriate for everyone, because it's hard to do, particularly if you're not ready. It's not the right thing. But getting to that later is sort of end goal.
Great. I love that. That is a really insightful model, and something I'll try and put up on the show notes as well, which is cool.
Awesome.
So where can people find you, Grace, if they're interested in hearing more?
Yeah. So I am on Instagram. My business and my private practice is called The Nourished Mind. So all about, obviously, nourishing the mind, the brain, the body. It's all, hopefully, takes that into account. So at thenourishedmind.au, my Instagram handle. I am seeing clients face-to-face in Balgowlah, New South Wales, in Sydney. So people can come in for a one-on-one appointment, but I also see people via Zoom, sort of telehealth setup as well. And you can find me on my website, www.thenourishedmind.com.au, and people can book in for an appointment via that.
Lovely. Well, I could talk to you all day, and maybe I will, but I better wrap it up here. Thanks so much for jumping on. It's so nice to get connected and hear more about what that relationship is with food and with ourselves and the mind and the body. So I'm keen to share this with everyone.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jackson.
Do you want to find out more about how therapy can help you kick some goals? Go check out findreasontherapy.com.au or the Find Reason Therapy Instagram page.